Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and we're going to be talking to an engineer today. We don't do that often enough, but this is a particular engineer who works for the Mayo Clinic. That's this famous medical facility in Rochester, Minnesota, with outlying places in Scottsdale and Jacksonville. And so what's an engineer doing at a Mayo Clinic? Russell, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Kevin Bennett from the Mayo Clinic. He's a division chair in the Division of Engineering. Kevin, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, we're happy you're here, too. But before we get on to what on earth a Division of Engineering is doing in a hospital-type facility, let's talk about Kevin. How did you become an engineer? What were those little driving forces that set you on a course?
Well, I guess, it started, of course, when I was a kid, as I think it probably happens with most people. And I was always interested in science. I was interested in nature, and my folks were very willing to help support that. And as a young child, they had built a house, and so I was on the construction site all the time seeing how these things actually happened. And it just kind of grew from there. And then when I was about 10 years old, 10 or 11, I had become very interested in science and had built an X-ray machine to X-ray my Christmas presents.
Good God.
And so that worked really good the first year.
These were days before the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yes,
I mean, X-ray facilities in homes?
That sounds rather dangerous. I mean, how did you do that?
Well, fortunately, I was able to read enough to realize it needed to be in a lead box, which was a good thing to do. And then my father happened to be having lunch with a chief medical officer of the facility, and he got up from the lunch table, went over, called his radiation safety people, and they came with sirens blaring out to the house. And once they got there...
Where was this, by the way?
This actually was in Okinawa, the southernmost island of Japan.
My father's a meteorologist. The Environmental Protection Agency didn't quite reach that far.
Exactly, yes. Of course, there was also a different time frame,
right,
too. And they did a survey and decided that, it was safe, and they wanted to build one, too. So,
but where'd you get a tube, though? I mean, that's not so easy to get an X-ray tube and make it work.
Well, at that time, living in Okinawa, there was down in the main street of Naha, the main city, there was a science supply store. And for $15, I got an X-ray tube. And then from there, using Scientific American and other sorts of
But, you know, it's quite an accomplishment because, I mean, you got to have, 50 KeV?
60,000 in 60? My case, but yeah, that's right. Exactly.
So I'm in awe, I must say. Yeah. At 10, I was interested in cricket, but X-ray tubes, I don't think that came even close.
Yeah.
And what were your first gifts? What were the ones that you X-rayed and said, it's a jigsaw puzzle or...
Well, the first gift actually was a series of model airplanes and model rockets from the Estes model rockets. Now, the second year, I was pretty cocky because this was working really good. I put them back under the tree, but I had to pretend that, I was surprised when I opened them.
So they didn't realize what you were doing?
No, not at this point.
Oh, come on. So, they got you an X-ray facility. Your father helped you get it.
But I was
X-raying what you're doing.
Well, I was X-raying lizards and things of that nature, but not the Christmas presents. Those I had to sneak from under the tree and go X-ray them. But the second year, I had gotten involved in photography in a pretty big way. And so I thought I was really smart, so got a present out from under the tree, X-rayed it, and I developed the film, and 12 rolls of film. So I had to pretend I was really, really happy about it and just threw them away. 20 years later, when I told my parents what I did, they thought it was really funny. But at the time, they probably wouldn't have.
So I got to go back to this because I'm a great believer in Christmas when children, and so we used to. But all the presents were put in when the kids went to bed on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
So I've got this vision of you waiting for Santa Claus to bugger off and then coming down at 3 or 4 in the morning.
We did it two ways. One, there were some gifts from the parents because they wanted to make sure that Santa Claus was different than their
right.
gifts. So there were gifts available.
Okay, this is great.
Well, I mean, even waiting for Santa to get to Okinawa was probably difficult.
we were all very worried on that island, and so, yes.
Well, anyway, there you are. You're an engineer already at 10, it's clear. So why the Mayo Clinic? What does the Mayo Clinic have to do with the Department of Engineering?
Well, that actually was kind of an accident of me getting to the Mayo Clinic. I was going to be there for 2 years. I had arrived to work on some laboratory automation projects years ago, but it evolved from 2 years into 20 now. And about 10 years ago, I was asked to chair the division, to join the division. And so I have a staff of 60 people. Engineers, programmers, technologists, machinists, a glassblower. And our task, to put it very simply, is to invent stuff. And so we have other groups. We have another 200-person division to repair equipment that we have on site. But in our case, what we're doing is we're collaborating with the physicians and the researchers to develop things that you can't buy. And so some of the projects that we're working on are bioartificial livers, devices for doing cardiac surgery through minimally invasive procedures, deep brain stimulation. So we do about 40 or 50 major projects a year and probably around 600
small ones. I mean, do you have commercialization and profit in mind here too?
Well, it is not a driver, but yes, it is important. So what we do is that we certainly don't want to duplicate anything that's out there. It's much cheaper just to buy it if it's on the market. It's less expensive to buy something and modify it. And the one we all love to do is clean sheet of paper. Okay, let's start fresh. Let's just make something new. But it's thought, and it tends to be true, that if we need it at Mayo, since we are so large, it's probably many other medical organizations will need it too. And so we work with our Office of Intellectual Property, as many universities have, to work on the patents, work on the commercialization. And in fact, one of the devices that we built for replacing the chordae in the heart, instead of a 3.5-hour open heart surgery, we can do it 15 minutes and they can basically go home the next day. And so it's a pretty incredible thing to do.
So, I mean, the basic research that goes into this then, that is funded from the proceeds of the clinics and the proceeds of whatever intellectual property you commercialize?
There's a variety of funding sources. We've got 58,000 employees, so the Mayo Clinic is pretty large. We do about $7.5 billion of healthcare each year, and of which about $250 million in research is funded by the clinic. Another approximately $250 million comes from the NIH and other granting agencies. And so my division is funded internally, and then we add extra funds for different research projects or different engineering projects.
I had no clue that it was such a big operation. I mean, 58,000 people, that's a well-sized city. Now, these are mainly in Rochester?
It's predominantly in Rochester. 28,000 people come to work every day in downtown Rochester, Minnesota. The clinics in Scottsdale, Arizona, and Jacksonville, Florida, are about one-tenth the size of that in Rochester.
And as with all successful enterprises, is there some thought about going international and having Mayo England, Mayo Japan, Mayo Beijing?
Yes, we get requests for that all the time. And, you know, one of the issues of our success is really the relationship between the different people. I mean, one of the things that we do very differently is that everyone at Mayo is basically on salary. And so it's very collaborative in that when a patient arrives at Mayo, we typically don't know what their problem is. And so we have one physician that would meet them, be their, if you will, their guide. And then from there, they would go to different laboratory tests, they would go see different specialists, and all this information would then be synthesized by the original physician. And so during the visit, probably a person would be seen by at least three physicians. So it's that collaboration amongst all the people, which help us because when we need to get a surgeon, an endocrinologist, an anesthesiologist around the table, we can actually do that. So it's a very collaborative organization.
You know, that leads to a question, though, because I know several people here in town that go yearly to a checkup. What is the cost? It's not cheap. Is it covered by health care, or is it private money?
It is usually covered by, it is covered by most insurance companies. I mean, you know, with anything, if you're going to another location, you need to check with your insurance company. But in most cases, our fees would be covered just like any other hospital. Yeah. The cost typically is many times less than what you might pay in a local area. So if you're coming from the East Coast or West Coast, we are less expensive.
Well, how does that work out? Because all your people are on salary and therefore the MDs, the surgeons, the anesthesiologists understand that there's a cap on their salary, perhaps at one level. I mean, they're not going to own basketball teams.
Yeah, well, it's not a cap. It's that what we do, of course, is try to maintain our salaries as competitive. But the idea is to provide appropriate medical care. Since the people that are involved in that care aren't going to gain from additional tests or additional procedures, all it's going to do is create additional work. Right. What we want to do is we want to provide the most appropriate medical care, but just that amount. And so, like, our laboratory testing is all reflexive. We do one test based on the results of that. Then we decide what other test we should do. rather than a more broad spectrum approach initially.
You also, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you do have sort of visiting surgeons. Seems to me I've got a good friend here in town who's a surgeon. Mm-hmm. That says, well, I can do it here, or you can come over and I can do it at the Mayo Clinic. So I say, well, I'll do it here.
We have the largest residency program in the world. So our training program, maybe a few seconds about Mayo Clinic, is that, yes, we do have in Rochester, Minnesota, we have two hospitals. We have the clinic operations. We have a medical school. So we give MD, PhD, and master's degrees. We're able to do that as a university. We have the largest residency program in the world. And so we are... One of our major jobs as a not-for-profit is to teach.
Right.
And so we do have a lot of visiting faculty. So it's, you know, during the training program, you might see people from all over the world.
You're developing lots of mechanical devices to cure various problems in the body. Now, what I'm interested in is if you develop one and you think it works, what process do you have to go through to get it accepted so that you can implant it?
Mm-hmm. And the answer to that would be, it depends. Okay, and the reason I say that is that we abide by all the FDA regulations that exist. But there's a whole variety of ways that could happen. And so let's say that we are, as we are, working on a new temporal mandibular joint. So these are people that have an incredible hard time speaking or eating or opening their mouth. And so they have a degenerative disease and need a joint replacement. So what we do within the Division of Engineering is we would get a CT scan of the skull. We would then create a plastic model of that joint, provide that to the surgeon that has already examined the patient, decided that this would be the best treatment, and then they would do a mock surgery on the plastic part and return it to us, and we would then build a replacement joint. And so because of it's a one-to-one correspondence between the physician, the patient, the specific problem, and going through the various approvals, we can then, of course, go through the sterilization and the quality control, and then that can be implanted.
So you don't have to go through clinical trials or anything like that?
Yes, we would have to, but it depends on the
product. Not for jaw replacements or something like that?
Not for this particular one, because we've already gotten the approval to do it on a custom basis.
You hear politicians in particular, you know, lauding the capacity of getting health treatment in North America and similarly in Western Europe. But it's clearly an incredibly expensive business. I mean, just that little sequence that you went through for one particular patient with one idiosyncratic problem, all right? I mean, you're making models, you're operating on the model, etc. Talk a bit philosophically about, is there an unlimited capacity for people like me to expect to be looked after as I grow older? I mean, at what stage does simply saying, panel, you're too poor to have this procedure? I mean, this is a big issue these days, obviously, but it's a valid question that I'm thinking. Do I want to spend all my money on prolonging my life another year at the end? When I get there, I'll probably say yes, but at the moment I say, well, wait a minute, my family coming after can probably use those funds.
You want to look at the bright side of death.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Again, Monty Python rears.
indeed. Well, these, of course, are very major issues, and I don't think there is a very clear answer. However, I think there's some things that we could consider, and that is that if we look at a society, one has to ask the question, what is the society going to produce? You've got to produce something. You have to have an industry. You need to do something in life. And as I look at it, healthcare is a darn good thing to do. So if we are producing, you know, let's say the next generation of automobile with, you know, looking back in history, you know, bigger fins than the previous one, or a new temporal mandibular joint that will allow people to speak and be a productive part of society, you know, I'd vote for the TMJ. That strikes me as something to do.
We'll come back to that. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli and Kevin Bennett from the Mayo Clinic, head of a division of engineering at the Mayo Clinic, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Genetics may play a bigger part in autism than scientists had thought. One thing we know for sure, it's not vaccines or poor parenting.
Scientists in London studied over 6,400 twin pairs in England and Wales, and all had been raised by their parents in the same environment. The incidence of identical twins having ASD, or an autism spectrum disorder, was between 77 and 99%.
That's much higher than non-identical twins, whose chances were between 22 and 65%. For years, we thought the environment played a larger role, but genes may figure more prominently.
We haven't identified any one gene responsible for ASD, but there are many being studied, such as EN2, a gene critical to midbrain and cerebellum development. Another is Reelin, a protein important in brain development that in adults is critical to learning and memory.
Scientists are looking at the role genes play in serotonin regulation since autistics consistently show elevated levels. Could this feel-good hormone play a role?
Another hormone system called arginine vasopressin may affect social behavior. One of its genes is now also a candidate for autism.
FOXP2 is a causal gene for severe speech and language disorder in a three-generation family. Because language impairments are a hallmark of autism, scientists are targeting this gene for a closer look.
These are just a few of the many genes being studied. As more people become aware of ASD and more children are diagnosed, the pressure is building to further understand this disorder.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Kevin Bennett from the Mayo Clinic, head of the engineering division. And Kevin's been telling us about all the wonderful things that they're doing for microsurgery, non-invasive surgery.
We were talking before the break about the costs of doing this and so on and being able to afford it. But the follow-up question that I have there really, which was the basis for my previous questions, was, can we remain competitive, or are we going to be doing this research, let's say, in Beijing or in Mexico because our regulations are much tougher than overseas?
That is an interesting challenge, if you will, to the United States, in that we do need to maintain our competitiveness. But there's several sides, of course, to any one of these equations. And if you look at a China or an India, for instance, with the billions of people that they need to serve, and if we look at the diseases that they're facing, many times those diseases or problems are different than what we're facing here in North America and in Europe. And by training many of their people over, you know, the last, you know, 30, 40 years, those people going back, starting industries there, they're creating products that they need in their location. Many of those countries are developing the equivalent of the FDA here, or have the equivalent of FDA here. And I have been in actually China recently, and we're talking with them about what it takes to develop devices. They are facing a slightly different issue than we are in that their per capita income is much, much less. And so, for instance, a cochlear implant, something that will give a person the ability to hear again. We in the United States would have a device that might have, and again, I don't know the exact number because it's been a while since I've looked into this, but something like 16 channels, 24 channels, maybe more channels. And that provides greater fidelity the more channels you have. But it's also one of diminishing results in that you can, at some point, you'll have so many channels the brain can't process that information anymore. So what are you really doing? Well, some of the people that I was talking with over in China are looking on a system with very fewer channels, that it brings back hearing, they can understand speech, they can have a very productive life, but it's a much less expensive device.
Yes, but we all know people that have gone for what we call eco-health because they can get a treatment that's still under approval here that they need. That's really the concern that I have.
I mean, it's not been approved here.
It's not been approved in the U.S., and it's going through a long process, so they go to Mexico City. I mean, we used to hear, I don't know whether it's effective, but that's really the concern, is our approval process really fast enough to remain competitive?
Yes. These are areas, of course, which I don't get really involved in. And so the answer to that would really be, the different regulations and requirements of the different countries are based on their situation. There are approvals in other countries before it gets approved in the United States, and our FDA is working as best they can to provide us the ability to have the products and the services that are appropriate. So I think the answer really may be it depends on where the devices are being produced. It depends on the regulations. And certainly there are discontinuities in the world markets, and sometimes things are available overseas before they're available here.
I remember several years ago, I mean, they have got a very flourishing industry in India on artificial legs and arms and things like that. Really cheap, right? But whether or not they've been tested the way Russell thinks that things shouldn't necessarily be tested is another matter. Do you have ethical panels? I mean, you're an engineer, but you're working in an area which has got all sorts of shades of ethical appropriateness, if I can put it that way. So do you have regular, for all the employees, sort of a regular sort of discussion of the ethics of various aspects of engineering, of science, of medicine?
There are certainly conversations about that. There are courses about that. We have ethics committees at Mayo. We like committees a lot in that we are managed through committees.
Oh, this is a university. We thrive on them.
Mm-hmm. We have the IRB for looking at the appropriateness of care. We have IACUC looking at the appropriateness of animal research. And so there's a very
But I was thinking more about yourself and your engineering division. Do they bring the engineers into these discussions at any stage?
Indeed, they do. It depends upon what the outcome is going to be.
For example, if a famous boxer came in and said, I want steel joints put in my fists.
Well, we wouldn't be involved in that one, so...
One of the big areas of, if I can put it, growth of the need for treatment is in neuroscience. I mean,
yes.
Dementia and more Alzheimer's. And I know that you guys have developed some rather interesting technologies using what I use in the laboratory, cyclic voltammetry, just for looking at how electrons are transferred from one metal to another and how much energy it takes. Could you discuss that? Because that's such a laboratory technique that the idea of utilizing it to study profound differences or activities in the brain is quite remarkable to me.
Yes, yes. And it's a incredible technique. I mean, it has been around for quite a number of years, but allows you to take measurements that there really is no other way of doing that. And the work that we're doing with Dr. Kendall Lee, one of our neurosurgeons, is developing the technology to create a deep brain stimulation package with feedback. And at this point in time, about 75,000 people in the United States have undergone deep brain stimulation.
And so tell us what deep brain stimulation actually is.
Okay. So what would happen is, let's say someone has Parkinson's or essential tremor, and so therefore they have a tremor that is making their life essentially unlivable. It's been discovered over many years in the neurosciences what part of the brain is in effect becoming overactive. And so by selecting that point, inserting an electrode, and applying of a potential of 1 to 2 volts approximately, you can actually disrupt that tremor and make the tremor go away. So it's a treatment. It's not a cure.
So it's a permanent implant.
Permanent implant.
With a permanent battery somewhere that you can replace every now and again.
Five years or so.
Okay.
That's right. Now,
so the battery, and I want to get this clear in case it happens to me, is the battery somewhere easily accessible, or they got to go back through the brain?
Well, actually, that's another thing we're working on, because right now you would have the electrode that would penetrate the skull, go to the maybe 3 inches into the brain to find the right target. Then you would have a wire that would come from there down the skull, down the neck, into the chest, and in the chest you would have something that looked like a pacemaker, the same form factor, and there would be the electronics package and the battery.
So it's working quite well.
For certain things, it works wonderfully. Now, there's some of the psychiatric issues that it doesn't work that well. And the reason is that, for instance, if we have someone with depression, I mean, clinical depression, that their life is just not working. We do know from neurosurgery, neurology, and psychiatry that we can make those people happy. But the problem is that their house could be burning down, but they would still be very happy. And therein is the problem. So what we are spending a lot of time on
right now. So there's a balance there with the judgment between happiness and danger.
Correct. And the way we're looking at it is we need to raise people to a normal level of happiness, and then their emotions can take over, and now they can become happier or sad and be a productive member of society.
Would it be fair to say, though, that when you're thinking of Parkinson's and the tremor or the inability to speak, that that's a more localized part of the brain, whereas emotion is going to cover a whole multitude of regions of the brain?
True, but we're not trying to affect emotion. All we're trying to do is reduce the depression, bring them out of depression.
Which you can localize in
Which can be localized, yes.
Section of the brain?
That's right. Now, remember, when you are working in one section of the brain, that is connected to many other parts of the brain. So it's a very complex issue. But what we're doing with fast-scan cyclic voltammetry is we have the ability to put in very tiny electrodes, 30 micron electrodes, and measure the neurotransmitters at that point. And so, therefore, we can do the stimulation and see the results.
Supposing you know somebody that's got a tremor or deep depression, can they become volunteers in your program?
At this point, we're not quite ready for volunteers in terms of the depression. But in terms of tremors, I mean, it is that part of the device is a commercial product. And so there are many people in the United States that are now doing that sort of implantation.
So that's so history and success.
We're working on the next generation.
Right. So what is the next target that you've got? Not maybe you particularly. Obviously, you've got a group of 60 people. You've got 58,000 employees up there. But what's for you, Kevin, the next sort of thing that you would go after, your holy grail?
Well, my holy grail, actually, right now, I'm spending most of my personal research time in the deep brain stimulation area. That is really the work I'm doing. Instead of having this battery pack that's rather large, shrink it to the size that can be the thickness of the skull, have the feedback loop, have the detection loop, have the entire device built into a very small device that provides that feedback.
So this is really miniaturization of existing technology, and therefore you would have new materials involved and lots of different interdisciplinary people helping you.
Absolutely. And the project involves probably 30 people at this point in time within Mayo Clinic and external collaborators, because we do need additional skills that we don't have at Mayo.
Do you go into the surgery when they're operating? I mean, you're
indeed
right there, so you can see the process, and that gives you a better idea of perhaps
what's needed. Our staff, and that's one of the benefits, is that we are an embedded engineering group, and so therefore we have access to the operating rooms, the laboratories. And if you Google DBS, deep brain stimulation, you'll actually see one of the operations of a concert master violinist that was gracious enough to provide the video.
So the first time you saw an operation, did you see the brain, and what did you think, that moment of, my God?
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Hey, Kevin, it's been a pleasure to have you on Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
When I was in school, I had a choice between going to med school and being a scientist, and it was clear to me, I want to be a scientist. I don't want to go to med school. But it sounds to me that you are sort of on the brink there. I mean, can you give any advice to students that are making a choice between science, engineering, medical school?
Well, I think the answer to that would be to follow your interest, follow the thing that you really love. Because as we look at our work, our people are incredibly successful when they're doing the things they enjoy. Then it's applied to a variety of other things. I would never have imagined when I started as a chemical engineer that I would end up in a medical arena in operating rooms participating in brain surgery.
So thank you very much, Kevin Bennett from the Mayo Clinic. Bye-bye.